Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, a live weekly roundup of Utah news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the Bureau of Land Management offers a $10,000 reward after a prehistoric petroglyph panel was defaced with racist graffiti. Utah's new homeless services coordinator says that rather than building a new shelter, existing facilities need to transition people out of homelessness faster. And the challenge to protecting threatened cultural relics in and around the Bears Ears National Monument, however large that monument may be. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Zach Podmore. Good morning, Zach. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate it. And we've also got reporter Bethany Rogers. Welcome to you, and good morning.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks, as always, Robert, for joining.
Yeah, good morning. Good to talk to you, Roger.
Listeners, you can join this discussion with your questions or comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW, or you can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. I'll mention, too, that you can listen live to this program at kcpw.org. We've got some interference with our broadcast that we are working to resolve here on KCPW, and sorry about that, but you can listen live online at kcpw.org. Let's start in southern Utah. And Zach Podmore, two stories that you wrote this week that tie into each other pretty well. One about the challenges to preserving cultural artifacts in and around Bears Ears. The other about some vandalism that happened outside of Moab, just a couple counties over, or maybe one county over, actually. And that's where I want to start. It's with the defacing of this petroglyph panel. Maybe just tell us what happened and, you know, just the basics here to start. What actually happened?
Sure, yeah. So there's, it's called the Birthing Rock or the Birthing Panel. It's on Cane Creek Road, just outside of Moab. Really, you know, pretty canyon that flows into the Colorado River. And it's popular with ATVs, UTVs, mountain bikes, hikers, just, you know, people driving up the road to camp. And anyone who's in that area goes, you know, within a few hundred feet of this really amazing petroglyph panel. It's a boulder that's kind of cube-like. It has four sides, and on each of the sides there's rock art, and, you know, dating back a few thousand years, perhaps 3,000 years, and wow. And including rock art as recent as, you know, just 150 years ago from Ute people in the area. So this is a panel that people have returned to again and again for a really long time. And despite its proximity to the road, there was no graffiti on this boulder until this week when somebody went down there probably sometime late Monday night and climbed over this small wooden fence that keeps people from touching the rock art or damaging it. Or, you know, lets people know that it's not something you should approach.
Right.
They climbed over it and wrote, you know, some really disgusting and racist things on there. They wrote white power on top of this, figure, this anthropomorphic figure. They wrote some other language as well. I guess I shouldn't repeat it on the radio.
Yeah.
And it's one of those situations where, you know, if somebody writes their name and the date, it's always a question of, well, did they just need education that this isn't something that's acceptable on any rock, let alone on rock art. But this was clearly a provocative, aggressive event that wasn't, you know, wouldn't be addressed through visitor education. It was something that was meant to get a rise out of people and to offend people, and it certainly did that.
There's a reward for information about this from the Bureau of Land Management. They're trying to track down the people or the person or people behind this. Can you tell us about that? And then I guess maybe you could talk a little bit more about the rock art panel itself. You mentioned that it's got this history. It's also important to Native peoples who live in the region now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like all the cultural sites throughout southern Utah, there are numerous, tribes currently living in the area that trace their ancestry to these areas and to the the people that, you know, created this rock imagery. So it's, you know, it's offensive to anyone, but it's incredibly offensive to, you know, people who are the descendants of the original inhabitants of the area. And, you know, people have been speaking out online quite a bit since this occurred, and just, you know, sharing their sorrow and their, you know, anger at, over this event.
And Zach, can I actually interrupt you there before we go to the reward? Your article quotes from a video posted to Instagram by Dr. Len, I think it's Nesifer, who tell us who he is, and then maybe give us a window into some of the, you know, that dismay that he was expressing about this incident and then another incident. Actually, your article points out that this is the second kind of high profile occurrence, you know, like this in as many weeks, though the last one apparently wasn't intentional the way that this one was. Can you describe that's a number of things together. One is the response, but maybe you should talk about the other incident with a climbing bolting that happened.
Yeah, so just last week, also near Moab, a rock climber from Colorado went up this, you know, pretty easy route, 5-3, which is, you know, not normally a route that needs bolts, but they put in metal bolts going up, you know, through several routes through another rock art panel that was, you know, equally elaborate to the birthing rock that was vandalized this week. And some of the bolts were, you know, sunk directly into the rock art, and it created a big uproar in the climbing community. There were kind of mixed stories coming out of the person who, you know, placed the bolts. At first, he was saying that it was, he thought that it was graffiti and not rock art, but then people looked through his Facebook and he was referring to the petroglyphs there just a week earlier. There was a whole back and forth among the community about what to do about this sort of thing. And Len Nesifer is a member of the Navajo Nation. He grew up near Shiprock, which was first climbed in the 1940s, I believe, by David Brower, actually a famous environmentalist.
Right.
And the climbing, the early climbing community there, Len was saying, was, you know, pretty disrespectful to the local people. They didn't get permission to climb Shiprock, which is in northwest New Mexico. They left glue and bolts on this, you know, sacred uplift. As a consequence of that and other incidents, the Navajo Nation completely banned climbing. And Len is a climber. He's the CEO of Native Outdoors. He does a lot of outdoor sports, and he tries to get, you know, more Native people involved with rock climbing and skiing and that sort of thing. So he was talking about kind of those tensions and conflicts within the history of recreation on Native lands and his own role as a recreationist. And it's a really good video. It's 28 minutes. It's on his Instagram, Len Nesifer. And I suggest people go and watch the whole thing. But yeah, he talked about both the bolting incident and the vandalism incident on the birthing rock, and spoke a lot about just kind of how the educational system in this country really glosses over the, you know, tens of thousands of years of indigenous history, and, you know, jumps right into the European history that we're more familiar with as non-indigenous people. So it's a great video, and it doesn't simplify any of the difficulties around these issues.
Yeah, and do check it out. You also spoke separately you spoke to a guide in Moab, somebody who talked about the area. I mean, I think we're all familiar with the concept of Moab being overrun with tourists, but there's this, you know, exploding population, exploding tourist use of this area, and this guide is saying that it's too much, basically. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same story, I guess, across southern Utah in a lot of ways. There's but it's especially serious in Moab, where the number of tourists is growing so quickly that nobody can really keep up. You know, they've had to build a new sewer plant in Moab in the last couple of years. They're building so many new hotels that there's traffic jams all throughout town on any, you know, busy weekend, which can last more than half the year. And then land managers also are facing the same issue. There's just so many people out on BLM lands, on Forest Service lands, in the national parks, that the land managers are having trouble, you know, keeping up with dealing with human waste and dealing with rangers and patrols and signage and education.
Yep.
And it's something that has, you know, consequences from everywhere from, you know, affordable housing to these incidents of graffiti. And it's another big and complicated issue.
We're going to stick with it. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-8255. And Zach, we'll still get to, I'll just mention that BLM law enforcement is, as far as the graffiti goes on the Birthing Rock, is accepting tips at 435-259-2131 or 800-722-3998. You can find that at Zach's article at sltrib.com. But I'm going to bring in news columnist Robert Gerke on this before we turn to other parts of this. And we're going to turn, Robert, to a story that Zach wrote before this happened that talks about the need to better educate people about, you know, cultural relics. And we'll turn to that in a minute. But just on this particular act of vandalism, what it did, what it said. Robert, I'll just have you give us your thoughts on it.
I mean, I think anybody who looked at the images of the vandalism on that rock, or you kind of have to be sick to your stomach a little bit, I think. It was obviously, as Zach mentioned, done with malice and intent to, you know, explicitly to damage these artifacts. And I think convey a message that I think most of us are at least object to. So, I mean, so it kind of raises a question, and it kind of segues into Zach's other story about how you keep this from happening in the future. I mean, my column for the weekend looks at that a little bit as well. And there's more than 100,000 artifacts scattered all over the state, and trying to protect them all is almost impossible. I mean, it is impossible. And this one, you know, this, as Zach mentioned, this one had a fence around it, which is more than most of them do. But when people have, again, malicious intent, there's really not a whole lot you can do. BLM, an archaeologist from BLM, has consulted with the tribes and tried to, I guess, to the extent they can, eliminate the graffiti. There are ways that they've figured out to do that, even though it's etched in there. It won't ever all go away, but it can be cleaned up at least to a large extent. So, it poses a real problem. And I think with the increase of tourists and recreationists and access to a lot of these artifacts, it's something that we're going to have to deal with. And it's because it's not going away, and probably, if anything, is going to get worse.
Zach Podmore, you know, Robert brings up the fact, I was going to ask you actually about the way that they were trying to clean it. I mean, this is a rock art panel, as you said, thousands of years of history, and then, you know, in an instant becomes something, it's not even laughable, it's very sad, it becomes defaced. I guess, what are they doing to try and conserve this particular and pretty well-known rock art panel?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact techniques they use, but they do, you know, have methods, as Robert said, for removing or making the graffiti less visible. It's been, you know, many panels have had some sort of cleanup across Utah, especially, you know, roadside panels that had 100 years of, you know, people stopping by and carving their names on the rock and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there are techniques for doing that. I don't know.
Roger, if you,
sure. I mean,
it's basically what, the way it was explained to me by one of the state archaeologists is that the contrast is actually because there's dust in the crack. So they go in and kind of take the, you know, try to eliminate the dust from, and it lessens the contrast. So it's less visible. They can kind of contour it a little bit, I think, to make it a lot less visible to, you know, visitors.
Sure. All right. Well, Zach, I mentioned that you had written this story that is extremely related to this, focusing on the Bears Ears region, which is also kind of getting loved to death, though it's, you know, maybe where the region around Moab was some decades ago. And love to death is probably not the right term for you know, despoiling of ancient and sacred sites, because that's not showing much love, but overrun. Maybe you can just introduce the topic here. This is an area that now has a certain amount of renown, and that's because of the National Monument designation, I think, in part, and that is presenting some challenges. Can you just describe what's happening in the area, the increase in visitation, for example?
Sure. Yeah, in the area that's now known as Bears Ears National Monument is, you know, in the original tribal proposal, it was nearly 2 million acres of land, and then as designated by President Obama in 2016, was 1.3 million acres. So this is a huge area, and collectively, it's been seeing increasing visitation for, you know, for 40 years, especially in the last maybe 15 years or so. It's been growing really quickly. There are probably 200,000 cultural sites throughout that region, maybe more. Only a handful of those had been surveyed by archaeologists. They can be anything from, you know, a fire pit in the ground to rock walls to the famous cliff dwellings and rock art that Bears Ears is known for. And so it was kind of, you know, 10 years ago when people started discussing the idea of protecting it in some way as a national monument or a national conservation area, and as the tribes in the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition got together to really push for that protection. One of their main concerns was the increasing visitation. So they said, you know, this area is so important for all the tribes in the coalition, as well as many other tribes. And it's just, you know, most of it was just BLM land. There's wilderness study areas, there's primitive areas, there's a collection of different designations that were in play there already before the monument.
Yeah.
But they really wanted more resources, more ways to protect those cultural sites and to direct visitors to appropriate, you know, cultural sites, as opposed to, you know, accidentally oftentimes, you know, stomping through a site that they don't realize is, you know, a midden with pottery in it, or finding pottery and putting it in their pockets. There's a whole, like, you know,
yeah,
range of needs for the area, from more law enforcement. There's barely any law enforcement in the area right now. One active law enforcement officer with the BLM currently for 1.8 million acres, I think. And then there's, you know, just a lot of even popular sites don't have signage or established trails. There's braided trails that go in and out of sites. There's erosion. So there's an increasing, or I guess the monument designation was pushed in order to address that, but then it also advertised the area, especially with the controversy and the reduction in 2017, and it's just, you know, continuing to stay in the news cycle year after year.
Right.
Visitation has exploded, and the resources that people hoped for haven't necessarily arrived, at least in the amount that the tribes had requested and pushed for back in 2015 and 2016. It's a kind of like Moab or like other places in southern Utah. I think it is fair to say it's getting loved to death in certain ways and could use more federal resources is what the intertribal coalition is calling for.
Right. And how the monument designation plays into that. Basically, there are some, I guess maybe it's kind of a weedy topic to get into, but the strength of, you know, the management plan, the amount of funding that goes towards resources. I mean, you said one law enforcement officer for however many, you know, 1.something million acres. And then education, I guess, you know, there's a guide who you speak to in your story. I mean, you frame a lot of the telling of the story through a couple of cliff dwelling sites that are in, and I think they're inside of the monument. depending upon which monument we're talking about, the downsized one or the larger one, but or, you know, the one that may be coming. There's a guide you speak to, a Diné, a member of the Navajo Nation, who says that this is really above everything about education, that, you know, education that hasn't happened. Can you talk about, I mean, Robert in his column talks about this as well, but from his perspective, this is about people just not knowing sometimes the damage that they're doing. Can you give us an insight into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the man that you're talking about is Lewis Williams. He's from Kayenta, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation originally, and now lives in Blanding. He's been a guide in the Bears Ears region for 10 years. And just this year, he opened up his own river and hiking tour business, which he hopes to have all Native guides leading people out onto the landscape and giving people a cultural education, as well as your average guided experience of talking about the history and the plants and that sort of thing. And he's, it was really instructive to go out onto the landscape with him a few weeks ago and get a taste of that, a taste of what his guiding process looks like. And it's so important, to have the education that he was talking about of, just the basics of don't touch the rock art, don't, scratch the rocks, obviously, don't take the artifacts, don't lean on walls, if you're walking up to a site that doesn't have fences or established trails in it, really keep an eye on where your feet are, making sure you're not wandering into a midden pile or crushing pottery or, walking on top of the site itself. But also just, he really gives you a sense for how these sites continue to play such an important role in tribal members living today. And there's part of the education that he tries to provide is getting rid of this notion that's, he says, is all too widespread among people he meets out in the landscape that indigenous people have, disappeared in some way, or they no longer return to these federal public lands to visit cultural ancestral sites.
And there's it's complicated. I mean, there's the people who drop in and they are recreationists, and so they don't have a sort of vested interest in the region, but they think of it as a playground. And I'm just going to define a term really quickly. You mentioned a midden heap. That's a midden pile. That's a sort of an ancient trash, heap, a place there where ancient peoples discarded a whole bunch of things, but is filled with archaeological, evidence and stuff. And I think that for listeners who are wondering what you were saying when you said that, I thought I'd mention that.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks.
No problem. We are running kind of low on time. We've been cruising through this, but you mentioned the fact that Williams, this guide, says he incorporates visit with respect principles. It's a program that the BLM developed, there's the conservation group Friends of Cedar Mesa and the Colorado Plateau Coalition who are involved in it as well. And you mentioned the principles that they have include leave all artifacts, don't touch rock imagery or make any of your own. Williams talks about, using rubber tips on the end of hiking poles so you're not marking up the slick rock. Keeping dogs out of archaeological sites, et cetera, et cetera. But Zach, how would you try and sum this up in a matter of a minute or so? We've got a lot of education to be done. Where do you start?
Yeah, so as the visitation was increasing and the federal government was struggling to keep up with the increasing impacts on the landscape in the wake of the original Bears Ears designation in 2016, Friends of Cedar Mesa, a local conservation group based in Bluff, stepped in to try and provide some of those educational resources. The federal government, the BLM or the Forest Service don't have a visitor center for Bears Ears yet. So Friends of Cedar Mesa opened what could be considered a visitor center. It's called the Bears Ears Education Center. It's in Bluff. It talks about the history of the area. And they also have a website that lists all of these tips. So, and it also has some of the sites that are more ready for visitation listed there. So it's a really good place to start if you're coming to Bears Ears, to read through the Bears Ears Education Center website, make sure you're following the guidelines to reduce impacts to these cultural sites, and then also finding the sites that are have been stabilized. Maybe they add stabilization to the rock walls, and a little bit of direction in terms of not getting lost when you're trying to get out to these places that can be really remote and just at the end of dirt roads with spider-webbed trails leading out there.
Right.
So it's a great resource, both the visitor center itself in Bluff and the website. So I suggest people check those out.
And Zach, one more thing: the anticipation is that President Joe Biden is going to increase the size of the Bears Ears National Monument. Maybe bring it back to what it was. Maybe make it bigger than it was. The question is: do we know that the funding necessary to to protect Bears Ears while also creating the monument? I mean, the whole point of the monument is to protect the area. Is the funding going to come with that?
If the monument is expanded, it doesn't necessarily mean there's more funding. That's usually the case, historically speaking, as monuments are created or expanded, that more federal resources go to that area, but it also, they kind of flow there in conjunction with increasing visitation. So some opponents of the monument say, you're only going to get more resources if you get more visitors, and therefore more impacts. It's something that's being debated right now. The Utah delegation is pushing for a legislative option to protecting this area, which would go through Congress, instead of a presidential proclamation, and that could have designated federal funding that would go to law enforcement, say, or educational resources or visitor center in the area, in a way that the presidential proclamation might not. John Curtis, the representative for Southeast Utah, including the Bears Ears area, is pushing especially hard for that, along with every other member of the Utah delegation. But Representative Curtis has been meeting with the Intertribal Coalition and trying to work out whether or not that might be an option. The coalition itself says, we'd like President Biden to expand the monument back to 1.3 million acres or even to 1.9 million acres, and then we could talk about legislation after that.
Sure. And protection, that the monument provides doesn't just have to do with tourism and visitation. It of course, has to do with the kinds of activities allowed from, extractive industries and so on and so forth. And so we've kind of, I think, maybe not talked about that side of the story, but that is the more kind of dominant backdrop of national monument designations and the Antiquities Act. But Zach, I think we're going to have to leave it there. And I was going to bring Robert Gerke back in, but we're running low on time. So I think we're going to take our first break in the show. But Zach Podmore is a reporter in San Juan County for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a quick break. And when we return, we will turn to the story of... I'm trying to remember what we're going to next. A homelessness czar, our homelessness services coordinator, and what he says about shelters. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers, Zach Podmore, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Bethany Rogers, we'll turn to you now, and a topic that we have tackled before: a new Utah office on homelessness and a new homelessness czar, her homelessness services coordinator. I like the sound of czar, so just bear with me on that. A few weeks ago, we talked about the appointment of this coordinator, and And, you know, we wanted to know where he stood on a variety of things. The Tribune editorial board landed, an audience with him, and now we have some ideas about his thinking. This is Wayne Niederhauser, a former Senate president, and the top-level headline here is that he doesn't think we need any more shelters the way things are right now. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, so this follows a couple winters of really overcrowded shelter system, especially in Salt Lake County area, which is where the longstanding road home shelter was replaced a couple years back by three new resource centers as part of a big shift in the way homeless services were delivered in the area. And because of those, you know, capacity issues, basically officials, especially Salt Lake City officials, have had to kind of cobble together interim solutions, opening temporary hotels and motels, converting them into temporary overflow spaces, and you know, using vouchers to try to sort of make up the difference, the deficit in bed space. And most recently, this kind of came back into the, we printed a story saying that Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, after these, you know, couple years of capacity issues, had concluded that, you know, the state really needs to open another shelter. There's just not enough available, enough space available to accommodate the state. As you mentioned, former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser came in to visit with the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board. So that was one of the questions we wanted to ask him, is if he does see that another shelter is going to be needed in order to solve some of these capacity issues. And he really wanted to take more of a, you know, he wanted to hold off on a lot of taking positions on a lot of the things that the editorial board asked him about. He's you know, was just appointed to this position. So he says he's still very much in the learning phase and listening phase of things. But on this particular issue, as you mentioned, he said that he thinks the problem isn't so much that there's not enough shelter space as it is people are spending too long in the shelters. The shelters or resource centers were always sort of envisioned to be very short-term, to provide short-term stays to people. People are not supposed to be spending many, many days there. And he says that, you know, because people are spending too long in the shelters, it's creating kind of a backlog. You know, they're occupying a bed for, he said, some people he's heard of staying hundreds of days. So because they're occupying that bed, you know, they don't move through and allow another person to come in and take that space. So he said the problem is really just that there's no place for people to transition after the shelter, that people kind of end up there and then just get stuck there.
I mean, this was, as you pointed out, the fact that there was a reduction in bed space, that was a decision that was made, you know, when these three new homeless resource centers were coming online. And again, the idea was, yes, you're going to transition people more quickly out of homelessness. And so you'll have that kind of constant move through of people. What are the barriers to that actually happening? How is it that people are getting sort of stuck in the resource centers? Can you talk about that, Bethany? Or that's a tough question to answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, the primary thing that he sort of identified as an issue with that is just the fact that there is a real affordable housing crunch in the area, that, you know, people could move to you know, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, deeply affordable housing, all these kinds of different spaces that are more designed for people to spend some time in and, you know, not like shelter, not a space where it's really supposed to be for an emergency situation. And so he said that there needs to be more analysis of, you know, what exactly is needed, but that, you know, in his mind, at least, the affordable housing issue is a really big piece of it, because there's just nowhere for people to go out of emergency shelter.
Right. From the resource centers, the idea is that a person, you know, or a family is helped into, I'm assuming, an apartment. And if nothing affordable exists, then how, you know, I mean, you have to get people on their feet enough that they are able to pay for an apartment. That's my understanding. And there, if there's no place to go, then there's no place to go. I guess that's an obvious statement there. So Wayne Niederhauser, the new homeless services coordinator, said that, however, that he could, you know, join in or agree with Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall if for some reason the state is unable to decrease the amount of time that people are staying in these shelters. So if it turns out that there's no possibility of them moving people through more quickly, that yes, conceivably he could be on board with building a new homeless resource center.
Yeah, he said, you know, the reality is that if people are treating these resource centers as long-term shelters, that you're going to need one, maybe even more of those to meet the need currently. So, you know, it definitely sounds like that's not his preference, that he would rather return to the original vision of moving people in and out pretty quickly. And as you mentioned, just getting people back on their feet. And that's the other thing to mention about the resource centers is each of them, in kind of in contrast to the Road Home shelter, which was, you know, pretty much just a shelter, but it was surrounded by a lot of different other service providers. These resource centers are supposed to be like one-stop shops where people can come and get case management and some basic health care and, you know, assistance for finding housing. And so in that way, people thought you could kind of get people, you could get, you know, individuals experiencing homelessness in there and then hopefully quickly connect them with something else beyond the resource center. So I also want to mention that I wasn't really able to confirm that, you know, people are staying in these shelters for hundreds of days. That wasn't data that the state had immediately on hand, but their last statewide report on homelessness did indicate that people are spending on average 55 nights in emergency shelters. That's the average length of stay, and identifying that as a potential is something to work on, that was well above where they would want to be.
Bethany, you may not be prepared to answer this question, but I'm wondering if, you know, you talked about that 55 night average. I'm wondering if the state is tracking individuals, meaning the people who spent, you know, who leave after 55 nights, are they leaving to more permanent housing situations, or do we know where they're going? Like, what percentage are actually getting out of homelessness through the resource centers?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I know that the state does have a tracking system or a system for trying to follow how individuals are moving in and out of the resource centers. But, you know, following individual people and figuring out where they're going can be a real challenge. You know,
sure.
It just depends on people's interactions with service providers.
And then, Bethany, you talk about it seems like a pretty significant increase in the number of people who are homeless. And this is, I'm pointing to the state's point in time count, something we were waiting for in terms of the data available. There's been, you know, over the 2019 numbers, there's been kind of an increase, hasn't there?
Yeah, the last point in time count found a 12% increase compared to 2019. So there was a jump in that one time count. There are, you know, they do caution when they're doing those counts. That is just a snapshot in time. The point in time count is obviously a sort of a census that they do on one night out of the year.
Right.
So it does give, you know, service providers and the state and everybody else some sort of a sense. But at the same time, you know, like I said, it's just the one night, and it is difficult to get a comprehensive picture of these things just because, you know, you're trying to find people who might be sleeping in a car, or, you know, there are people experiencing homelessness who are staying at a friend's house. So piecing together a holistic picture of homelessness can be very difficult. And that's one of the challenges that Senate President, the former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, who's now the homeless coordinator, is trying to address. He's long called for better data collection on providing homeless services. And he said that strategic planning and having sort of a cohesive vision is going to be very important to him going forward.
Just going back to the number of beds, you write that Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall, you know, before she became mayor as a member of the city council, she was among those who expressed concern that there wasn't enough room in the facilities. Originally, I remember there was a plan for more facilities, but that got whittled down. Yesterday, just on a related topic, the city announced a partnership with the Other Side Academy to develop a tiny home village, which eventually could have as many as 500 residents. I believe that that's entirely apart from the rest of the, you know, the sort of homeless services system at the state level, if I'm not mistaken. Though Mayor Mendenhall talked about it in her press conference, talked about it complementing those services. And this is a story that was covered by the Tribune's Taylor Stevens. I urge people to check it out. Let's bring in Robert Gerke, the news columnist. Robert, just on the idea of, I mean, we have this conversation a lot, but the need for enough space, the need for affordable housing, this plays also into your column on the growth of the state of Utah that is happening pretty significantly. Do you want to talk about homelessness in the context of the growth that we are experiencing?
Well, I think if I could frame it up a little bit,
sure.
I mean, as Bethany mentioned, the new homeless services director, Wayne Niederhauser, kind of acknowledged that we don't really know what the demands are. And it's kind of, it's one of those things that you would think that several years into this effort to combat homelessness, we would have a better idea what the needs are. It seems pretty clear that whatever they are, they're not being met now in terms of the housing options available, which is why we have this backlog in the shelters and why we have people living on the streets. And so, it's going to take a holistic approach. And I think it kind of, it dovetails nicely with the tiny homes piece. I mean, there've just got to be housing options there. You can't solve homelessness without homes. And so we've got to be able to put a roof over people's heads. That's going to be not just a short-term shelter stay. So, it all kind of fits together. And you know, I wrote a few weeks ago that I supported the mayor's call for an additional shelter, because we're kind of, throughout COVID, we've kind of done this piecemeal thing where we have hotel rooms being deployed or employed. We still have increase in camping, and we have, you know, shelters. There's space in the shelters, so people are not necessarily, you know, they're not being turned away, period. So it's a complex problem, and it's probably one that you've mentioned growth with the rapid growth we're seeing that doesn't show any signs of letting up, and in a continued housing crunch, we're going to have a real problem, you know, solving this in the near term without a lot more resources, and particularly in the housing front.
Well, with that, I think we're going to take another break in the show. Bethany, there's more to your story. I'll urge listeners to check it out at sltrib.com. And I want to squeeze in, if I can, one more story of yours when we come back after this break. We'll see if we have enough time. Listeners, you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be back in 1 minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Zach Podmore, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning local news roundup, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio and heard here locally on KCPW. I want to quickly squeeze in a story about guns and medical marijuana. And Bethany Rogers, you wrote a story that is at the intersection of those two things. Your article is essentially about the conflict in between state and federal law. And the headline reads, "Can Utah's medical marijuana users own guns?" Why is that a question? And, well, what's the answer, Bethany?
It's a question because, as you mentioned, marijuana is still federally illegal, even if it is, you know, even if someone's using as part of a state-sanctioned medical program like in Utah, or if you're living in a recreational state. you know, it's still technically against federal law. So anywhere where, you know, federal law sort of dips into a situation, there can be complications for medical cannabis users. And that one of those areas is in the purchasing and carrying of firearms. So, yeah, so I just looked into that and found that technically, yes, the answer to the question is yes, they can own guns, but it's a little bit complicated. Buying guns from a registered, you know, a licensed, federally licensed firearms dealer is not an option for people who are medical cannabis patients, unless they want to answer, you know, to lie on the federal form they would have to fill out, which would be illegal. But they are able to buy through private transactions where no background check is required. And then the ownership of guns is also fine. They can carry guns, especially now that Utah just passed the law allowing people to concealed carry without a permit. Previously, they would not have been eligible for that permit because the state likes to issue those permits in compliance with federal law. And so since federal law would disqualify a medical cannabis user from one of those, you know, from the permits, the state has followed suit, but now those permits are basically largely irrelevant for Utah gun owners. So that's also opens up more freedoms for them.
Sure. I mean, you talk about the fact that most of the people who, I mean, to kind of, if you're following the letter of the law or going to a T, you have to go through private, as you said, a private, you know, buying a gun privately and, you know, sidestepping things like background checks. It's kind of an interesting dynamic there. And Bethany, I'm so sorry to have to like just cut this very short, but we're out of time. And so I'll say thank you for covering this for us. I'll urge listeners again, check out Bethany Rogers' story at this at sltrib.com if you're a subscriber. Let's turn now to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And this is just where we highlight a story that maybe we didn't cover before. And why don't we bring in Zach Podmore down in San Juan County? We've kept you on mute for a while. Zach, what's your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you're ready?
Sure, yeah. Julie Jagg, a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, wrote a story about three school districts in Utah who have moved to a option where parents can sign a form that says their kids should be medically exempt from having to wear a mask in school. It's the San Juan School District, Kane, and Iron Counties. It's just it's a great story that gets into kind of this era that we're in now, where many adults are vaccinated and many kids aren't, and we're nearing the end of the school year, and all of the tensions and complications that are resulting from that with regard to mask use.
It's interesting that it's based on parents' judgment as opposed to, you know, I don't know, a doctor's judgment or something like that. But definitely an interesting story. I've not read it. I'll check it out at sltrib.com, and I encourage listeners to do the same. Robert Gierke, news columnist, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, also a COVID story. Andy Larson has another terrific explainer today that where he tries to answer people's concerns or address people's concerns that are preventing them from getting the vaccine at this point, the vaccine hesitant, if you will. And he goes through a list of here are the reservations that people have, and here is something you might want to consider, I think. So if you know anybody who is balking at getting the vaccine, or if you yourself are, you may want to take a look at that at sltrib.com.
It's a great piece. It was one that I was thinking about highlighting myself. So thanks for that, Robert Gierke. Your pick for underplayed story of the week is Andy Larson's story. Yeah, breaking down sort of vaccine reticence, but also reasons why people might be hesitant to go and get it or holding off. And he basically gives you many reasons to go and get the vaccine. Bethany Rogers, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, my pick is an article written by Tony Simrad, my colleague, who took a look at Utah's really tight competitive housing market, especially along the Wasatch Front, where apparently people, home buyers, prospective home buyers, are sometimes offering as much as $100,000 over the asking price.
It's really an amazing story and kind of a bizarre moment that we're living in. Here as growth, this ties into Robert Gierke's article on growth as well, and a column on growth. And so check that out at sltrib.com. vaccinedoctors.com. I was going to highlight the fact that there are, I think, thousands of vaccine doses available in Salt Lake County. And I think there's a walk-in option available at various places. I can't find the article that I was going to reference on this, but you can find it somewhere at sltrib.com. The Salt Lake County Health Department says, look, for a time we didn't have enough vaccine doses. Now we don't have enough demand, and so we are encouraging people to sign up. You can find out information about signing up for vaccines at coronavirus.utah.gov. And I will just say, Zach Podmore, Bethany Rogers, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today on Behind the Headlines. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can join us live every Friday morning. You can also find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And I'll just say that you can support this local public radio resource as well by going to kcpw.org and making a contribution. We always appreciate that. Thanks very much for listening. And check out everything we've been covering at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.